Welcome back. It is Rethreads Podcast 280. I'm Gary.
And I'm Christine.
And we have a collection of guests tonight. We have back with us Rich Ross. Hi, Rich.
Hello. Hi, guys.
Matt Wandell.
Hey.
And also from the Steinhardt Aquarium, Nick Kim. Nick.
Hey there. How's it going? It's actually Nick Yim.
Yim. Nick Yim.
Yeah, yeah.
Up, Gary?
Got it.
You say a collection of guests like they're specimens.
Well, we'll see when this is over, huh? So, Nick, welcome to the thing here. Good to have you, first timer. Yay!
Oh, thank you, Gary.
Yes, and as always, we are brought to us by the Rod's Food thing. That's right. We determined last week it's a whole thing now. So, well, I did. Christine doesn't. Yeah. So. So we have the original blend, the fish eggs. Get the fish eggs. We have the what is that green stuff we call that?
Seaweed.
Seaweed. Thank you.
Algae.
Yep, algae. There it is. That's what I was after. We have the freshwater blend, largemouth, smallmouth, Pacific plankton, coral blend, breeder blend. Yeah, a whole bunch of stuff. At your local fish store and at Foster and Smith. So there we have it. Thanks, Rod. So tonight, Rich, Matt, and Nick all going to talk about new things that are going on at the Steinhardt Aquarium and diving experiences and what they're seeing. And we just got kind of a mixed bag of things. But the thing we want to start off with first here is the new Twilight Zone exhibit.
Yeah.
Who can talk about that, Matt? Nick?
Yeah, I guess I can start talking about it a little bit. Well, we've been developing this exhibit for the last several years, and the whole intention of it is to explore and show the what's called the mesophotic zone, or also known as the twilight zone of coral reefs. And it's basically talking about the area just beneath the surface. The scuba diving surface of coral reefs. So it's the area about 200 to 500 feet deep on coral reefs, and it's a little too deep for most scuba divers to visit, and it's a little too shallow to be worth it for ROVs to visit. So it's this very unexplored space in coral reefs with lots of new species to be discovered.
Is this where we use the rebreather system?
Yeah, so we have a team of deep divers at the academy that are able to go down all the way down to as deep as 500 feet and go down there and do exploring. One of them is Luis Rocha. He's an ichthyologist, and he's down there looking for new species, doing transects and population surveys to see what the life is like down there. A couple other deep divers are his graduate student, Hudson Pinheiro, and Bart Shepard is our director of the Steinhardt Aquarium, and then our dive safety officer, Meridius Bell, is the other deep diver. And so those guys go down there, and they're collecting fish for us, essentially fish and corals, gorgonians, the likes of which have never been seen before. So, yeah, we're displaying all those.
That's exciting stuff. Oh, I'm sorry, Christine, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, are these collected from a particular area of the world? Are you sticking to one ecosystem, or is it a broad spectrum from wherever you can get things?
The exhibit has stuff from all over. The deep divers have visited several places around the world. The places that they've collected from, right now we're just limited to the Philippines and Vanuatu. And all three of us, Nick, Rich, and myself, had a hand in one of those collection trips where we basically are the ones that take care of the fish after they're collected. So yeah.
Now this is the kind of stuff where you developed I think it was you, Matt, that developed a little pressure container that's made bringing these fish up faster possible.
Yeah, that was me. I mean, it was kind of a group effort, but
the bat made it.
But it was Matt made it, and it was totally Matt's idea. Matt came. I remember him coming to my desk one day and saying, "Hey, I've got this idea for a pressure chamber. You want to help?" So Matt's shoulders.
Yeah, Matt actually did all the acrylic work too, didn't he?
Actually, the acrylic work is mostly MRC.
And he made artisanal glue to keep everything together.
Yes, yes. That is true. I had heard that rumor as well. He's quite the craftsman, this Matt. So, honestly, so My Roof Creations, Raj had at least some help in this endeavor. That I do know.
Yeah, Raj built the inner sleeve for it. So basically the pressure chamber for the fish is akin to a diving bell for a human diver. So it's just a way to bring the fish up to the surface at pressure. And then on the surface, we can decompress it slowly. And then the fish, is adjusted to normal atmospheric pressure at sea level, right? And then we don't have to needle them, which is kind of a problematic thing with, most aquarium collected fish.
So this is letting you bring up more fish faster?
I don't know about more fish. It's actually kind of a slow process because, you know, it's more gear that they have to carry than a simple hypodermic needle. But what we do think it allows us to do is get a higher survivability rate. And, you know, Rich and Nick can speak to that too. When we bring animals up and if everything works the way it's supposed to, we get about 100% survivability. So, you know, we consider these animals very, very valuable and basically irreplaceable. So we want to make sure they have the best chances at survival as possible.
And that's compared to what kind of survival rates were you getting before the chamber?
We don't know because we never really tried it with needling. We just know that, you know, historically from what we've heard through other people that have used needling for very deep fish, a lot of them don't make it.
This is another place. I know, you know, some of us keep talking about data. We need data about the trade and the hobby and the industry. This would be another great place. If we had the data, we would be able to tell you more about exactly what's going on. But the anecdote is that, you know, needling fish seems like a really bad idea and that stuff seems to not make it for various reasons through the chain of custody. And it all seems to come back to decompression, the deep stuff at least.
It seems it's kind of if the fish themselves weren't so valuable that you didn't want to, you know, potentially sacrifice one, this is a perfect case for a controlled experiment. It's one of the few times in aquarium science that you can actually perform a controlled experiment, or at least semi-controlled, if you take two fish and needle one and decompress the other. It would be interesting to sort of follow them.
We've definitely talked about doing that, and with the new Coral Reef Initiative at work, we've got funding for this for at least 5 years. So hopefully we'll circle back around to doing stuff like that.
Cool.
So when you bring these new species up, and it's been my understanding that just about every time that one of these dives occurs, it's not too tough to come up with new species. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, they're coming up with new species on a pretty regular basis. You know, they talk about known knowns and known unknowns. And unknown unknowns, right? It's this sort of weird concept that there's a lot of stuff that's down there that they know it's an undescribed species. They know it's a new species, but it's known about. Just recently we had a butterfly fish that we brought up that it wasn't until we put it into an aquarium that we realized it was an unknown unknown, which means nobody even knew it was down there before. And it definitely hasn't been described by science yet. So there's probably a lot more stuff like that out there that we just have yet to discover.
So this is pretty exciting on several levels then, to be doing this kind of diving and collecting and be able to bring these fish up and have them survive. That's got to be putting you guys really at the center of a lot of activity.
It's pretty cool. It's if you're into rare fish and being a fish nerd like me, it's a pretty awesome opportunity.
Now, when you get these fish up and get them in the tanks, talk about that in terms of getting them acclimated and feeding them, getting them to eat. Are you dealing with a lot of parasites, or what kinds of things are you dealing with?
Nick, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, none of them have really been that hard to get to eat, it seems. They've all been pretty hardy fish. We haven't seen a ton of parasites, I think. The first real parasites we saw were on the last batch of fish that were collected from the Philippines. There was, I think, one fish that had a couple copepods on it. But those are the only ones that I can remember. Can you remember any others, Matt?
No, nothing really major. There were those ones that had the attached, I don't know if they were copepods or isopods or whatever, but and then those recovered from that. But otherwise, yeah, they've been pretty straightforward. We've had some with some sort of remaining kind of a little bit of floatiness, but then that goes away within, you know, a few days or whatever in captivity.
Yeah, what kind of medical treatment are you guys doing prophylactically when you bring them up? Is there any sort of medical intervention that takes place before you put them in the tanks as far as clearing them of parasites medically or chemically? Or do you just watch and observe and then hope for the best?
We pretty much just do a 30-day standard observation. And then if they we do a series of scrapes on them to check and see if they have any parasites. But if they come up clean, we clear them from quarantine. But if they don't, then we'll determine the course of treatment for them.
And in terms
Matt,
of, go ahead.
Matt, why don't you talk, you know, the feeding, I think it's the way we get stuff feeding seems like it's really easy, but I also think that it's something that we've been doing for 10 years now, the way we approach getting difficult or new fish to feed. I think it's probably worth you talking about that for a minute.
Well, you'll have to remind me when we do that. I don't know. My strategy is always just like feed them a lot, and usually I just start with something simple like adult brine and baby brine because we have it on hand, and just get something in their bodies, get some calories in their bodies. Butterfly fish will sometimes take the live blackworms, but the whole goal is feed them like, you know, six times a day, you know, just get them eating and then start folding in, you know, frozen food to that regime.
We find that getting them eating anything, so we'll try anything live to get them eating. We just want them eating, and we find that they start picking at all different kinds of food much faster if you just get them eating anything they're going to eat. If you're trying to get them a particular food, it seems like we run into a more difficulty. So that's our strategy, is throw everything at them and just get their bellies full.
And this is small feedings throughout the day. This is not your typical twice a day thing.
Yeah, exactly. Really frequent stuff, just a little bit at a time. And I think one of the things we've noticed doing this is so – what's really unique about the experience we have – is that we're basically taking the fish from the time that they're on the reef all the way to the time that are in our aquariums in San Francisco. So there's no middleman, right? You know, a typical fish that's in the aquarium trade may go for weeks, you know, before it makes it to a fish store. And who knows how well it's been fed during that time. For us, in some cases, you know, we're catching a fish, we're decompressing it. About 48 hours later, it's in San Francisco, right? Just its gut is devoid of food just long enough to, you know, make the shipment. So they're not getting starved. We know that they're being handled well. They're not put in tiny bags for too long. They're not sitting on a tarmac at, you know, 90 degrees or in the sun on a boat or something like that. And what we're seeing is that, you know, when you treat and handle fish like that, they take the food really well, and they just seem to adapt really, really well to a controlled environment and just seem to do a whole lot better in general.
Yeah, we like the order to collect idea rather than the supermarket approach.
Yes. The when you're quarantining them, I assume that each fish is isolated, or are you able to mix them? How are you handling that in the quarantine?
We've been mixing them together in groups. Basically, we've had them all in big, around 375-gallon tanks. All the fish we collect from one expedition will all go into one tank usually, unless they're, you know, some bigger fish that are going to get eaten, that are going to eat at smaller fish or smaller fish that are going to get lost. But yeah, they've been all quarantined together usually.
Okay. I'm surprised at that. So, but yeah, I mean, I can see advantages there in terms of them learning from each other to eat and the community situation, but I figured you'd say they were all isolated so you could observe each one individually.
It's tough to pull that off on a, and realistically when we're getting back, you know, we'll get back 30 or 40 fish or something at a time. We simply don't have enough space, quarantine space. That's always at a premium for us. You know, there, besides our fish, there are lots of other animals at our aquarium that, need quarantine space. At any given time, we have, you know, cold water fish, we have freshwater fish, and those all are in the same, quarantine room. So it's easiest for us, you know, if we get a bunch of antheus, peaceful fish that'll get along with each other, you know, butterfly fish, antheus, basilids, things like that. We'll just put them all in the same tank. And, yeah, it's easier to just broadcast feed them that way. And then, you know, do water changes on one big tank rather than several smaller ones.
The other part of this that intrigues me is, you're dealing with new specimen, new species, and people want to describe them. As I understand it, that usually requires a dead specimen. How are you dealing with that in terms of these new species and getting them described?
That's a really good question. So I just had this conversation the other day with Louise, and we do have one specimen. He went back, and I'm referring to that butterfly fish that I talked about a little bit earlier. It's a new species of Roa butterfly fish. And he was considering how he's going to describe it without a specimen, without a holotype. And he was thinking that it would be possible with really good photographs, with x-rays, and with a fin clip to supply DNA. I don't think it's ever been done before, but he was considering it. After he hoped that that was possible, he then dug through the archives, I guess, and found a specimen with this trait that we think is new. So fortunately, we won't have to do that. But it would be really interesting to try. You know, it's a good question. If there's only one of them and it's in a tank and it's alive, we probably wouldn't want to sacrifice it. And at the same time, if it is a new species, it's kind of a conundrum, right? Because if it dies, and if you don't catch that it died right away, it's going to be a little bit too decomposed to use as a holotype. So, we haven't run into that problem yet, but I don't know what we would do if we did.
Yeah, that's just kind of been the thing. Every time I've heard talk about fish from this region, this depth, that's the thing that sticks in my head is if you get one of those up and get them alive and go to the effort that you guys are going to, the last thing you want to do is sacrifice it just so you can describe it. I mean, that's just really right. Counterproductive.
Yeah,
it probably is something that we're gonna run into with the next few trips, right? I would assume.
I would imagine at some point, yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, the discussion has been that you know, we're collecting them from display, so the descriptions have to wait, and hopefully, you know, we catch it before there's any autolyzing happening.
How does that work as far as how that decision is made? I imagine it's somewhat of a business and financial decision, but then the scientific staff, I would imagine, would get a little antsy about being prevented from doing their work. So how do you decide who takes precedence?
We wrestle for it.
Oh, awesome.
Matt and Rich have to wrestle for it.
We have to fight Louise.
So clearly the scientists have all of their holotypes, is what you're telling me.
it's just constant discussion from what I've heard. There hasn't been any, since it hasn't happened yet, it hasn't had to come to blows. But I think the idea seems to be that we want to put them on display more than we want to describe them.
I think that's true. Basically, Louise is like totally a fish nut just like us. And, you know, the one time that it's really popped up and been a serious discussion, he was like, no, keep it on display because he wants to see live fish in tanks just as much as we do. And, you know, he knows that he can go back to that reef, hopefully, and find another one.
And it sounded like he was pretty optimistic about getting approval to describe the species without having the specimen.
Yeah, he did seem pretty excited about that.
Well, to have that be a first would be, I mean, that itself is an accomplishment, and it's paving the way for a different way of cataloging species. So I would imagine, you know, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Do you find, go ahead, Gary.
No, do it.
I was going to say, do you find that, so bringing the fish up in a different way, in a way that you're assuming is a healthier way that leaves them more robust, do you find that their behavior aside from eating is different than fish that are brought up stressed and with a much longer supply chain time?
Nick, do you want to talk about that?
I mean, from my experience, it seems like eating would be the biggest concern there. I mean, they're probably less shy and more likely to come out, which would probably lead to them eating sooner. But aside from that, I can't really think of what are the differences it would create.
They seem to be out more faster than fish that come through the traditional chain of custody to me.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they're also just healthier, and you know, they don't come in with as many parasites or problems like that.
I think one thing we've noticed is that I know it's hard kind of in the aquarium industry to find really big, like super males of some types of animals.
Yeah, like the
big Borbonius and stuff. And I wonder how much of that is they're not getting deep enough to find them, or if the really big ones just don't do as well with the shipping and everything, and they're just kind of getting beat up a little bit more. But I know we have some big antheas that, you know, you don't really, aren't really available at all, in the aquarium trade. So yeah.
This is interesting, because I mean, you guys are obviously in on several fronts at the very front edge of this whole fish collecting and displaying effort, but this really is speaking strongly to our conventional supply chain for collected fish, and clearly you're demonstrating that if there's a different approach, that the survival rate is much higher all the way through to the final home.
Absolutely. I mean, we know why that is. It's a, you know, it's a business. And, you know, if we were to rack up how much our fish cost to get back to the U.S. and everything, I mean, we, you know, it would blow your mind. It's the cost is obviously we're trying to, you know, not spend too much money, but, our first priority is getting really good quality specimens. And I don't know if consumers would be willing to pay what these would cost. And so that's a challenge, right? Yeah, for the aquarium industry.
You guys are an official Zoological Society organization, correct?
We're members of the AZA.
Yes. Does these things that you're doing, this front edge collecting and display, do you run into regulations with the AZA, or are you, is it pretty easy to stay in compliance with those? Because there's some pretty strict rules there, as I understand.
I'd have to think about what the rules actually are, but, you know, that's just par for the course. So it's nothing, it's what we do all the time. You know, it's how we treat the animals all the time. So we're inspected every 4 years to make sure we're up to snuff, and we're hitting all the everything we need to be hitting to continue to be accredited. So it's just business as usual for us.
Okay. Let's talk about this display now, the Twilight display. Talk about size of it, what fish you have in there, what your experience has been, what are you using for aquascaping? What kinds of things are you doing?
Nick, you want me to go first, and then you can talk about your tanks?
Yeah, we can just kind of work our way around.
Yeah, sure. As you walk into the gallery, the first six tanks are relatively small, anything from as small as about 7 gallons up to about 180 gallons. The first tank we have is the benthic tenophores, also known as comb jellies, also known as sea peeps by some people.
They're so awesome. I love them. Except don't ever call them sea peeps again.
You're on my side of that argument. I think we should call them benthic tenophores and assume that people are smart enough to figure it out. Yeah, so those are cool. And we have a tank that's dedicated just to those. They're on, they're sitting on some wire coral. They have these great big long tentacles that they unleash, and those catch planktonic food. Let's see. We've got a tank dedicated to red fish, which talks about the color differences as you descend deeper into the water as red light gets absorbed and how red fish appear black down at depth. There is a Twilight Zone Caribbean display that only has Caribbean animals in it. We have a fluorescent coral display that has it shows how corals look in the daylight versus in actinic light, right? It's like every trade conference where they're keeping corals under actinic light. It looks very different when you get them in your tank. We've got a new discoveries tank, so that's just talking about new species that we've discovered or that were discovered by other people, but they haven't been described yet. And then there's also a tank that's just kind of cup corals, dendrophilia, tubastria, just a bunch of different, like, large polyp non-photosynthetic corals that we're calling deep water corals. And then at that point, it goes to one of Nick's tanks, and I'll let him describe that one.
So the next tank is our Nautilus exhibit, just kind of your typical Nautilus. It's a really tall exhibit to give them a lot of vertical room. And then along with them, we have pinecone fish and a cool species of Brachyla that we collected this year in the Philippines. Then the exhibit next to that is our biggest exhibit in the gallery. It's our kind of our general Indo-Pacific fish exhibit, so kind of our catch-all display where we have Borbonius antheus, Rosa fasciorhasses, multicolor angels, Bellis angels. There's a Polynae grouper, so it's kind of a bunch of different deep water fish in there. Then next to that we have our flashlight fish exhibit, which is, I believe, the only exhibit that stayed from the previous gallery. And then it's your benthic exhibit, Matt.
Yeah, you skipped the Hawaiian coral tank.
Yeah. My bad. Yeah, before the Nautilus, there is the Hawaiian deep water exhibit. So it's all species that are endemic to Hawaii. So there's a banded angel, Tinker's butterfly, and some flame wrasses.
Now, when I was last there, one of the neat things you had was each of you were able to set up your own tank and do it any way you wanted, and it was just kind of your personal little playground. Is that all gone to make room for these twilight fish, or is that still in place?
It's kind of parallel with it. It's still there. It's actually changed names. It's called Animal Attractions now, and it's mostly referring to different reproductive strategies and things like that. That section is still there. We actually carved out a different location for the Twilight Zone exhibit.
Okay.
And one other tank that we just forgot to mention was it's called Benthic Corals. It's about 300, 400 gallons or so, and it's just a lot of different, like, crazy weird gorgonians and whip corals that I had never even seen before, and I'm guessing most people in the hobby will have never seen before. Weird stuff. And we're just kind of trying to learn how to keep it alive. And then we also have in that tank, Sakura speciosa, which is this really cool, awesome antheus. We have a male and a female. And to our knowledge, nobody has ever exhibited them before in a public aquarium. So, they're really, really cool fish. If you get the chance to, Google what the male looks like, he kind of looks like a bucket of Neapolitan ice cream.
Coolest fish in the world.
It's kind of our showpiece.
Now, when it comes to these twilight fish, are you doing anything different with the lighting or water than you would with more standard reef animals?
Yeah, I mean, all the tanks are dim. We have them on. I mean, we have, like, these little LED fixtures over the tanks, and in most cases they're up pretty high above the tanks, and we have them turned down to, you know, I think like 30% or something like that. Very blue, of course. Then we also have a lot of shading on the lids of the tanks to keep light off the sides and just to kind of restrict the light to the center of the tank. So that cuts down on a lot of the light too. So yeah, it's very dim in there, just enough to basically see the fish and see what's going on. Temperature wise, I think for the most part, most of our tanks were keeping around 72 degrees. Yeah, just to, you know, keep them at their natural temperature range. It's kind of tricky because, you know, these guys are diving to a fairly, consistent depth in a range of about 300 to 400 or 500 feet, but the temperature down there is not consistent based on dive site location, which island they're on, whether there's upwelling, whether there's a thermocline. So they may see temperatures anywhere from like, you know, low 60s up to 75. So it's kind of a challenge to, you know, some of those fish may need some of those lower temperatures and some may be perfectly comfortable a little bit warmer, but we think we're erring sort of right in the middle and compromising for everything, while still staying cool enough to, you know, keep them happy.
Yeah, I'm surprised.
Go ahead. Temperature tends to be one of those things that I think fish adapt well to if you give them enough time.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I'm just surprised you're not chilling those tanks. I figured that was a given that you had to chill them.
Oh, yeah, we're definitely chilling them. Well, we have a unique way of chilling our tanks. There's not actually a chiller next to the tank. We have what's called heat exchangers, which is basically a titanium coil with fluid running through it that's very cold. The fluid's about 40 degrees, I think. And that fluid is chilled outside the building, right? So the heat generated by the compressor and the chilling process is shed outside the building and not inside the room right next to the tank. It's really the way to do it if you have the space and money to do it. But yeah, we're definitely chilling our water.
Okay. What are you using for aquascaping? Is there anything special there or just a few rocks and keep the lights down?
For my tanks, I've got kind of, you know, like a lot of little butterfly fish and antheus and things like that. So I'm using quite a bit of live rock, and a little bit of, Marco rocks. And then I do have a couple pieces of fiberglass in some cases to just sort of make the fiberglass rock work is just a little bit easier to make, like, you know, some vertical surfaces and overhangs and things like that.
Most of my exhibits are bigger, so they have fiberglass inserts. They're fabricated inserts that are made of fiberglass. And then I also have some pieces of Marco rocks for kind of filler and accent pieces.
Okay, so nothing really unusual there at all then?
No, not really.
Yeah. Pretty standard hobby stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of flow?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. in one of my tanks, so it's about 300 gallons, I have the return from the sump is probably something like, 1,200 gallons per hour or so, and that's going through a 1.5-inch sea swirl. That alone is probably enough flow for the tank for, you know, weeks to months, I would imagine. I think I'd start to see detritus build up and maybe see some of the corals start to not look so hot. But in addition to that, I have two MP60s on one side of the tank, Vortec MP60s. And then on the other side, I have a Hydro Wizard. I think they're called Hydro Wizard Mediums or something like that. It's the one that's a little bit bigger than a beer can. I have to turn that down to about 40%. Otherwise, it's just like ripping corals off the rock. There's a tremendous amount of flow in that tank. And I don't know. It just seems awesome. Like the fish are just out and loving it, you know. And the Gorgonians and sea fans that are in there, I hope, appreciate it.
Boy, that's a lot of flow. Wow.
Yeah.
And what made you decide to do it that way?
I don't know, experience. Just knowing that you almost can't have too much flow in a tank. I mean, I can just see that it kicks up food, and food's always moving around, and you know, there's not going to be a whole lot of detritus buildup, and I mean, just flow is king, right?
Yeah, and we hear the descriptions of the dive sites from the divers that go down there, and we see their video, and we see a lot of the dive sites, especially ones with a lot of Gorgonians, have a lot of really kicking current and flow.
Well, that's exciting. I got to find an excuse to get out to San Francisco now and see this. That's exciting stuff. Let's move on to the main reef. Now, last time we talked, you guys, Rich, you're still heading that up, and you guys were making good progress at getting that thing on its feet and getting corals established and fish healthy and in place and a good mixture. How is that going? What's new there? What have you learned? What things have gone on since we've last talked?
Well, we moved from cautiously optimistic to relatively optimistic about the corals. So so a bunch of stuff. We have a long list of things that needed to get done to the tank, and over the years we've been ticking them off because it's a huge beast of a tank. So getting anything done on it is much more difficult than buying a new power head and dropping it in your tank. There's the engineering staff, there's the medical staff, there's the water quality staff, there's us, there's the exhibit staff. So, you know, we getting things done takes a long time. For instance, we realized that the ballasts that were driving most of our lights were located like 380 feet away from the lamps. And the manufacturer's recommendation for the maximum distance was 378 feet. So we were within 2 feet. And we think that they were driving the lamps strangely. So it took us a couple of years to be able to get the lamps local to the ballast, or the ballast local to the lamps. That just takes a lot of time to get it done. And now things seem to be growing much better. We're running GFO, we're running carbon, you know, some things that just weren't initially built in the tank. And then we have to dial them in for that tank. So we had a problem where we were actually running, we think, you know, because of course none of this is studied and there is absolutely no control possible, that we were running too much GFO and we were actually fueling cyanobacteria with the fines that were coming off the GFO. So that took a year to figure out and deal with. A bunch of stuff like that. And then, you know, now we're adding more and more animals, in terms of corals and things. You know, the fish population has always been pretty okay, and pretty robust, but now the corals are holding both stony corals and, soft corals.
Where are you sourcing your corals from? Or is it all dive related, or are you taking things from other aquariums as well?
We get things from other aquariums as well, and we are also trying out some mariculture pieces. So we're going to do mariculture pieces and aquaculture pieces. For reef building corals, we want to do that wherever we can. So that's kind of the goal, to get the tank up and running and producing. And we'd like to be supplying other institutions with, you know, hundreds if not thousands of fragments coming out of that tank a year. So that's a pretty big goal.
What are the next steps? What's the next? I always find it fascinating when you talk about this reef, and because as hobbyists we forget, we don't have a bureaucracy we have to deal with, and we don't have to get approval to buy a pump. We just go do it. And when you talk about it takes a year to figure this out and all the things, it's just so it doesn't fit with what the typical hobbyist does. And I can see good things there in that it takes time and patience is key in this hobby anyway. But by the same token, I'm sure many instances you're just itching to get something in place because you know it'll make a difference.
Absolutely. It's gotten a little bit better. Last year, we switched roles around a little bit, and I became primary on the tank. So I'm more of a Joe Iulo role of the tank as he is on his tank. Although we're still a team, but and just having that change allows me to ask for things faster than it used to be able for me to ask. So a good chunk of discussion is removed because I can say we want to do this instead of having to work to get buy-in from the whole team. And of course, the team tells me if they think I'm crazy, but most of the time they have their own stuff to do, so they just trust me to run it. So the thing that's on our radar right now is to upgrade our skimmers or to make sure they're dialed in and working properly. So if we have to add new pumps, you know, bigger pumps on the Venturi side to get more air into them, or you know, figure out how the water is being delivered to them, we there's a governor valve on the skimmers that is keeping the flow constant. But what that really means is the flow isn't constant. The flow is within a range, and the valve changes a little bit every couple of minutes to keep the flow
where it, within small parameters. But what that ends up doing is it's bouncing the level of the water in the skimmers. So we don't really get to build up a stable foam head. Every few minutes, they bubble over and then they recede. So that's the thing that's next on our hit list to get fixed up. And hopefully we'll have that done within the next 2 or 3 months, which is actually incredibly fast.
Let's go out into the actual ocean and, you know, hearing all kinds of stories. Alex Rose was with us a couple weeks ago and had been in the Great Barrier Reef and all the bleaching that's going on there. You guys have done a lot of diving. What kind of conditions are you experiencing when you dive? What do the reefs look like in the different areas you've been in? What's the water like? And, you know, all this plastic that we hear about, is the just debris pollution a big issue in the places you've been? What are you seeing out there?
Who wants to go first?
You, Matt.
All right. Let's see. Last time I was out diving was in the Philippines in January. It actually wasn't for work, but I'm kind of always working in my head when I'm out there. And actually the reefs look great. I was in Analao, which is a place the Academy visits regularly, and then I was also on a little island called Malapascua, where there's thresher sharks that you can see that come up shallow, which is really cool, but a whole nother topic. And the reefs there actually looked fantastic. I didn't see any evidence of bleaching, certainly not widespread bleaching. And it's the Philippines, and it's a third world country, and they have something like 100 million people on those islands, so there is debris, there is pollution that you see, and in some cases the animals are using it as habitat, and in some cases it's, you know, it's tangled fishing lines and stuff like that. And one thing I did actually experience while I was there was my first being underwater while somebody was dynamite fishing nearby.
Wow.
So that was fun. I mean, of course I had heard about it and sort of knew what it involved, but I'd never experienced it underwater. And I was with a group of, I think, something like 6 to 8 people. And I assumed that somebody's tank had blown up somehow. And I just hear this loud boom and I'm looking around with wide eyes. I was with my brother and he was doing the same thing. And we were kind of like, what just happened? And then I looked at the dive guides and both the dive guides were like business as usual, completely calm, no big deal. And I was like, oh, okay, and slowly figured out what happened. And then we got to the surface. And then over the next few days, it happened a couple more times. And then I felt like a veteran after a while, but you never quite get used to that feeling. It shakes your whole, all your bones and everything.
I was going to say, yeah. That's got to be almost a concussive force in underwater, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And you know, when we came up, we could see the boats that were actually doing it that were probably, I don't know, probably about a mile away or so. But I mean, it feels like it's coming from everywhere. It doesn't feel, you know, it feels like it's all around you. And I don't know how they know how far away divers are and what the safe distance is and all that, but it was pretty freaky. So
was that in Analao or in Malapascua?
That was in Malapascua. We've never experienced dynamite fishing or heard dynamite fishing in Analao. I think I've done about 50 dives there or so over the years. But Malapascua, yeah, we had it happen several times. And, but otherwise the reefs there were actually pretty great. I would say there was the one exception was we saw some damage from, the typhoon that passed through there several years ago, and hit Cebu pretty hard. And we did see, actually some damage that they said the dive guys were telling us was fairly down deep. They said, there was this big Gorgonian that actually had a bunch of pygmy seahorses on it. And when we saw it, it was kind of in this channel. It was actually pretty ripped up and you could see that it had been really heavily damaged. And I was like, you know, what's going on there? What happened to it? You know, it didn't look like a nice big sea fan. And they said that was all from the hurricane that came through. So, yeah, otherwise things looked really great there.
Rich, how about you?
I just can't stop thinking about, when I was in Borneo and there was dynamite fishing going on while we were underwater. Almost the exact same experience, Matt. I clocked it and Libby clocked it. None of the other recreational divers clocked it.
and the dive guides, you know, when we got up to the surface, they were like, yeah, that happens all the time. Just the shocking, weird, thing that just, impacts your entire, it felt like it was resonating inside my whole chest. It was crazy. Other than that, I haven't been out, anywhere since this bleaching started. So I'm actually really interested to get back out again. In August, I'm lucky enough to be going down to Florida for the coral spawning again. So I'm interested to see how that's going. The only other thing I can add is that our deep diving team, is telling us that there's plastic, 400 feet down in the ocean where they're doing stuff. So the plastic is everywhere.
That's just sickening is what that is. Just sickening. Yeah, I was reading an article about, the bay where they're going to do the boat races for the Olympics outside of Rio, and how they just literally dump raw sewage into that bay all the time. And these boats are going to be racing in pretty much raw sewage. And you just would like to believe that at this juncture in our history, we're better than that, but clearly not. And plastic that deep, that tells you there's just a lot of plastic everywhere. That's a shame.
Yeah, and it's really interesting, right? Because like when the groups are looking at the aquarium hobby and you know like the anti-trade groups that want to say we shouldn't be collecting fish because we're damaging the reefs, you know, of course everything can always be done better, but we are such not the problem that people should be paying attention to. It's all such a distraction from what's really causing damage to the reefs. And I wish we could all get on the same page and deal with that stuff rather than have to, you know, fight these little battles that really are not going to make much of a difference in the long term.
Yeah, so very true. Nick, what have you seen in your diving?
The last two places I've been was the same place as Matt's been, the Philippines. But then I was in Vanuatu for one of our deep collection trips, and there was no signs of coral bleaching there at all. Everything looked really great and healthy, and yeah, they're really nice, pristine reefs.
So once again, the oceans are vast, and depends on where you go in terms of the quality of the reefs and the health of the animals then.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
We need to wrap up here, but I did have one more question. I'm sure Christine has one too, or maybe not. I don't know. Sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot. But when you're out on these deep dive trips, I assume that's very much different because those guys have to spend so much time underwater decompressing. Is that a very different kind of dive trip than your standard reef diving?
Yeah,
they're totally different. I mean, our main function when we're on those trips is to be there for support for them and to receive the animals that they're bringing up in the chambers. So we're kind of just, most of the dives that we do when we're on those collection trips are really short dives where we just basically drop down, meet them, receive the fish, and then bring the fish back up to the surface. So they're usually maybe 15, 20 minutes long. And yeah, we don't really get much time to explore the reefs or do other kind of fun dives.
Okay, so you answered my question then. How do they get the chambers to the surface? You go down to wherever they're decompressing and get them then.
Yeah, right. So yeah, it takes them what, like their actual bottom time is maybe 20 minutes, and then it takes them another 15, 20 minutes to get up to about 100 feet, where we meet them. And then they hand off the chambers, and then they take them another like 3 or 4 hours until they're able to surface.
Yeah. So one nice thing that sometimes does happen though is depending on the location, if we're real close to our sort of home base, we'll be in a separate boat and we'll jam back to shore so that we can get the fish hooked up to the home base kind of aquarium setup. But if we are out in kind of a remote location, we've got to stay there all day with them anyway. And so we'll get the fish hooked up to the chamber pressure setup on the boat. And once everything seems to be kind of copacetic and stable, we might have enough time to jump in the water and do a fun dive because we know that they're not leaving for another 3 hours anyway. So we have plenty of time for us to get in the water and kind of do some exploring and go down and visit them. And we can see them, of course, and we can ascend, but they can't. And we can, you know, bring them Capri Suns and bring them bananas and take tanks off of them and you know, try and entertain them as best as possible and stuff like that. So, yeah.
There's also talk of extending these trips to do a shallow water collection, Bart, as well. So the support team will stay and do everything that Matt and Nick just described, but then they might stay for another 4 or 5 days and do some more shallow water diving and collecting for you know, the other exhibits that are in Twilight Zone as a way to get it to be less of a workhorse trip and to get some funner dives in as well.
Yeah, because that's the part that was sticking in my head was for you guys who are used to going on these trips and diving and collecting and seeing things, sounds like you're pretty much stuck on the boat just being support, and that's got to get old after a while.
Yes and no, right? I mean, it's cool stuff.
Yeah, true, yes. Yeah, that's exciting.
There's also a lot of time on land after we catch the fish and bring them back to our operation base, decompressing them and bringing them up to surface pressure.
Yeah, it's work.
We're basically staying up all night too, in intervals. Sleep is kind of like a newborn baby. It's like you sleep for a couple hours and then you got to go downstairs and decompress them a little bit more. There's no automated, I'm working on it, but there's no automated way to decompress them. You have to manually go down there and sort of loosen a valve a little bit to do it. So, yeah, until I figure that out, it's, you don't get much sleep.
Do you have some kind of protocol for, how long it takes to decompress the fish? I assume you have some method.
No, not really.
Okay.
it's kind of play it by ear. It kind of depends on how deep they were when they were collected. And what we're finding too is that some fish are a little bit, quicker to decompress than others. I know on this last trip, the method we have set up is we have two, sets of chambers so that they can dive one day, use those chambers, and then the second set goes out the next day while the fish are still decompressing, and then they alternate, right? So the short version is the fish can decompress for up to 48 hours. Well, what they were finding was with some plectranthius, little perchlets, that wasn't even enough time, which is kind of bizarre because they're a really small fish and generally very small fish decompress quickly. But these weren't. So we're seeing that, you know, some species decompress at different rates than others. And I would love to, you know, spend 10 years and get a PhD in figuring out different rates of fish under controlled conditions. But, you know, it's the ability to do a controlled study on it is just like mind boggling. It would take so much time and money that, it's not going to happen anytime soon, but I would love to do something like that.
But nonetheless, a whole nother set of data and notes that I'm sure you make on each fish just to be able to do better the next time.
Yeah, absolutely. And definitely we kind of the way they come up, the rate they come up, we sort of shot for a curve that approaches what human divers do, which is kind of this logarithmic curve. When they're deep, they start to come up relatively fast, and then you spend a lot of time in the shallows at, like, you know, 40, 30, 20 feet, and coming up very slow at the shallowest part. And that makes sense from just a mathematical perspective. The greatest pressure change differentially is in the shallowest portions. And that's why you're supposed to come up really, really slow on safety stops and stuff like that, just considering the bubble size in your tissues. But now I'm getting into crazy dive physiology, and that's boring.
Matt, talk about Boyle's Law. Talk about Boyle's Law.
No, shut up. We're definitely sort of getting a routine down, and our hope is that, you know, this starts to happen like clockwork, and we're not even thinking about it anymore.
Yeah, that's fun stuff. Well, before we do get a lesson in Boyle's Law, I think we're going to end this thing. boy, I really appreciate all three of you joining us. This has been fascinating stuff. And obviously anybody, as I've said many times, if you're in San Francisco and don't go to the Steinhardt, as far as I'm concerned, you missed the best part of that city. It's one outstanding facility with aquarium displays like you won't see anywhere else. Really terrific stuff, so be sure and see it. And thanks to you guys for joining us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks
a lot.
All right, with that, Reef Threads Podcast 280, we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Take care.